Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In 2012, corporate profits hit their highest levels on record. In 2014, the total of all bonuses handed out on Wall Street was more than twice as much as the total earned by every full-time minimum wage American worker. The Walmart-Walton family own as much wealth as the bottom 40% of America. These are just a few examples today's guest, Thomas Frank, gives in his new book, Listen, Liberal, to show that 8 years after the 2008 financial crisis, the wealth gap and inequality continue to rise. Increasing inequality and poverty are happening under the watch of the Democrats, the political party that was once a militant defender of workers and the middle class. In his new book, Thomas Frank writes, quote, "These affluent Democrats do not give a damn about inequality except as an election year slogan. As we know, many Democratic leaders regard such voters as people who have nowhere else to go. Regardless of how poorly Democrats perform on inequality, they will never be as awful as those crazy Republicans. But my purpose here is to scrutinize the tacit Democratic boast about always being better than those crazy Republicans. In truth, what Bill Clinton accomplished were things no Republican could have done," end quote. So who are today's Democrats, and what role does class play in the party's agenda? Thomas Frank is a journalist and author of many books, including the best-selling What's the Matter with Kansas? His latest book is called Listen, Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. Thomas is founding editor of The Baffler, and he writes for Salon. And he joins us from the studios of NPR in Washington. Hi, Thomas. Welcome back to the show.
Well, it's good to be here, Rose.
Well, it is great to have you. Now, in this election season, so much of the attention is on Donald Trump and the implosion of the Republican Party. But you have really focused your book on the Democrats and how they have abandoned their legacy of trying to appeal to working class people. Why did you decide to ask this question, what's the matter with the Democrats?
Well, it's a... I guess it comes from, you know, being President Obama, you know, being in the White House all these years and seeing inequality get worse and worse and worse. Look, we just came through, well, we just 8 years ago came through this terrible financial crisis and recession. And I think that a lot of Americans understand that something has changed structurally or permanently. And that their, you know, the lives they had before the Great Recession are never coming back. And so I wanted to ask why that is. I mean, we have this man in the White House that we are assured constantly is the most liberal of all possible presidents, if not an outright communist. And yeah, and yet things seem to be going in the opposite direction. And so I wanted to know why.
Well, and you write that this is not another collection of familiar beltway gripes, complaints about gridlock. I mean, we hear this on and on and on about gridlock in Washington, or how appalling it is that Americans are so polarized. You write that the failure I'm referring to is bigger than that. With the exceptions of global warming and the Soviet threat, it's the greatest public problem we have faced in our lifetimes. How did you come to that conclusion?
It's inequality. Well, it's the middle class world coming apart. It's on. We are on a, you know, express train back to the 19th century, and everybody knows it, at least subconsciously. Everybody can see it. Now, for a lot of people, this ride has been really wonderful because they're sitting in first class. You know, it's like, you know, it's very luxurious. It's a wonderful time, and they're very happy with the way things are going. But I think for the vast majority of Americans, you know, they're watching their world come apart, and they're very upset about it. And by the, and you see this manifested, of course, obviously in the politics around us, both in the sort of sensible Bernie Sanders variety and in the kind of you know, outraged, crazy Donald Trump variety.
And so, Thomas, I mean, what you've done in your book is you took a look at how the Democratic Party has really changed over the years. And I mean, it has drastically changed because you've got quotes from former presidents, former people who worked in the White House, who really did talk about the importance to stand up for everyday workers. And they were honest about it, and they did it.
Yeah, it was absolutely essential to who they were. Now, look, Democrats over the years have had a lot of – there's a lot of things wrong with them, and you can complain about them in all sorts of ways. But there was always one thing that they were very good at, whether we're talking about Franklin Roosevelt or Lyndon Johnson. you know, again, these are men with a lot of flaws, okay? These are people who did a lot of things wrong. But one thing they were very good at was standing up for the middle class. This was second nature to them. This is what being a Democrat was all about. And we were, that's also who we were as a people, the great middle class nation, where even working class people enjoyed a middle class standard of living, you know, suburban home with a car, you know, all this sort of stuff, or at least they could aspire to that. That was something that was possible. But it's those days are gone now. And what you see instead, I mean, the Democrats are very different now. Barack Obama, who I should point out is a man that I voted for both for president in the primaries. I used to live in his in his state Senate district back in Chicago. I voted for him then, too. This is a man who, you know, a politician that I have voted for many times over the course of my life. If you look at what he's saying now, it is basically a siren song of complacency. Everything is fine. You know, there's nothing we and you know, look at what's, you know, when he looks at what's happening to working class people, it's basically he shrugs his shoulders. Nothing can be done about these people. And this is the Democratic Party generally now. Nothing can be done. Things are great. And, you know, I don't want to hear your complaints.
You point out that, you know, it's important for us to remember that in 2008, Obama raised more money from Wall Street than the Republican candidate. You also have this little tidbit in your piece about a meeting on March 27th, 2009. Obama was a brand new president. He got together with a room full of very nervous Wall Street CEOs. He warned them about the pitchforks of an angry public, but he reassured the frightened bankers that they could count on him to protect them. He had no intention of restructuring their industry or changing the economic direction of the nation. And you quote Ron Suskind, the journalist, in his book, who wrote, quote, lots of drama, but at the day's end, nothing much changed.
Yeah, yeah. And Suskind was quoting a banker who was in the room with Obama. At day's end, a lot of drama, but not much changed. And I think that's the epitaph for the Obama administration. And that's happened in the first month that he was president, the first month that he was president. If I want to go back to the first fact that you mentioned, that he outraised his Republican opponent on Wall Street. It was the first time that had ever happened. Generally speaking, over the course of the last 100 years, Republicans always outraised Democrats because Republicans were the party of business, and that was obvious, and Democrats were the party of labor. And it was, you know, obviously Republicans would do much better than Democrats. And that only began to change with the Bill Clinton presidency. But Barack Obama was the first Democrat to outraise the Republicans specifically on Wall Street. And then as president, did these kind of amazing favors for these guys. I mean, given the context of the time, the context of the time meaning everybody thought in 2009 that he was going to fire a lot of top bankers, unwind the bailouts, put a lot of banks out of business, maybe prosecute some guys. All of this stuff was on the table. And in that very first meeting, Obama basically assured them it wasn't going to happen. By the way, I was working for the Wall Street Journal at the time. I was a columnist, and I remember when this came over the, you know, this quote, I'm the only thing that stands between you and the pitchforks, when Obama said that to the bankers, and, you know, I was writing op-ed columns for the Wall Street Journal, and I remember that all the other columnists that wrote about this regarded that remark with outrage. They were like, Obama is threatening these guys. He's tacitly threatening them. But in fact, he was telling it straight. He was the only thing standing between them and the pitchforks. And he did protect them from the pitchforks. And it goes on to this day.
And you also write that, I mean, he surrounded himself with the same people Bill Clinton surrounded himself with. He named Tim Geithner the bailout architect, his treasury secretary, and then the deregulation architect Larry Summers as his main economic advisor.
Yeah, and he brought in a number of other Clinton retreads as well, and including Hillary, of course, and also including who was the Attorney General, Eric Holder, and Rahm Emanuel. I mean, they were all over the place, basically. But I'll tell you a little ironic story. One of the reasons I was very excited about Barack Obama in 2008, about the hope, you know, was. I thought that he represented a chance to break the grip of the Clinton wing on the Democratic Party. That's one of the reasons that I supported him in 2008. And as soon as he got the presidency wrapped up, as soon as he was in there, he did an about face and brought in all the same people that had been responsible for for getting us into the situation that we were in. I mean, if you go back to the Clinton years, and I realize I've just said something that's going to sound strange to a lot of your listeners, but the Clinton administration was, when we talk about bank deregulation in America, it began under Ronald Reagan, but it was really the Bill Clinton administration when things went into high gear and when banking was they really just took the rules away during the Clinton years. And that was not a good precedent for Barack Obama to return to, but return he did.
Thomas Frank is the author of the new book, Listen, Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. We'll talk about the Bill Clinton years in a bit, Thomas, but I wanted to ask you about your title, Listen, Liberal. Tell us about that. Who are you talking to here?
I'm talking to people like me. I'm pretty liberal. The title comes, there's a number of different sources for the title. C. Wright Mills wrote a book years ago called Listen, Yankee, about Cuba. And I was also thinking of back when I used to spend a lot of time in Kansas. I remember one time I was in Wichita and I was supposed to meet a guy for a breakfast meeting. And he came by the hotel I was staying in and called my room. And I picked up the phone and I answered the phone and here's his voice. And he says, "Rise and shine, liberal." I always thought that was pretty funny. And so I made it the title of the book. But it's specifically about a certain kind of liberal. Okay, this is not United Auto Workers style liberalism that I'm talking about here, or civil rights movement style liberalism. The kind of liberal that the book is addressed to, well, remember you said that I'm at the NPR headquarters in Washington?
Yes.
That's who it's addressed to. It's the NPR liberal. It's the New York Times liberal. It's the affluent white-collar liberals who really make up the party's most important constituency nowadays. That's who the book is addressed to. And by the way, Rose, these are people who really are not interested in the message. This is what I've learned since the book came out. These are people who really do not care about what I have to say.
What do you mean by that?
You, present company accepted, of course.
Yes.
it's a long story, but it's just very hard to get the book to get people to pay attention to what I'm saying here in America. I mean, in foreign countries, it's pretty easy, but here in America, it's been very difficult. And I'm not complaining now. I'm not complaining. I'm just telling you what's going on.
Well, no, but that's interesting because we had Jane Mayer on, author of Dark Money. I mean, an amazing book about the Koch brothers, about how the states have completely flipped to hardcore conservative Republican. We've had so many people on the show who have written great books. Michael Waldman, the president of the Brennan Center for Justice, about the vote. They have all said the same thing. They cannot get TV, mostly TV interviews, because the producers are telling them that it's all Trump all the time.
Yep, that's. I wouldn't say that's my experience because I don't talk to TV producers generally, but something like that is going on. I mean, nobody wants to. And look, I admit I'm selling I'm bringing a controversial and unpleasant message. Uncomfortable. Let's put it that way. What I'm telling people is that the Democratic Party is a class-based party, but it's not the class you think it is. It's not about working people. It's not about the middle class. It's the class that they're interested in, the class that they serve, the class that they flatter, that they say such nice things about, and the class that all the Democratic leadership is drawn from is the professional class. And this is who the Democratic Party is about nowadays. And when you want to understand why they've done what they've done, why they've been so disappointing on equality issues, why they've been so bad on Wall Street, why they've been so, flattering to Silicon Valley. So they will not bring the rule of law to bear on certain industries. It all goes back to this class story.
And again, your title, Listen, Liberal. How do you describe the word liberal now? Because a lot of people don't use it. They tend to use progressive, for example.
Yeah.
So what does liberal mean to you?
Well, I it's it's admittedly a loaded and difficult word, and it's Franklin Roosevelt that gave it its sort of modern definition in America, meaning, you know, someone who is on the left and pro-labor and all that sort of thing. And then in the 1980s, the word fell into such disrepute after, you know, Jimmy Carter and Walter Mondale. By the way, Carter himself didn't like the word. Carter did not like to call himself a liberal. And then Walter Mondale, you know, this sort of series of disasters that overtook the Democratic Party, George McGovern in the 70s. And so you get to the point that by the late 80s, the Democratic nominee for president, Michael Dukakis, would not call himself a liberal. Do you remember this? They started calling it was like a scandal. They called it the L word because he would not say it. He wouldn't say the word. And so that's where progressive people just started using that as a synonym. But I don't think it's really the same thing. At any rate, what I'm going for with the title is I'm speaking to, I think, a very specific group of well-to-do, affluent, white-collar professionals who happen to be, you know, the rank of the main, I should say, constituency of the Democratic Party. And the argument is this: that what you see with the Democratic Party today is a liberalism of the rich. Mm.
Thomas Frank is author of the book Listen, Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. So what do you think? Whatever happened to the Party of the People? What do you think about today's Democratic Party? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. In his new book, Listen, Liberal, Thomas Frank writes that liberals like to believe that if only Democrats can continue to dominate elections, if only those awful Republicans are beaten, the country will be on the right course. But look at where we are today, widening inequality. I mean, last week we did shows about how so many people are now working. They're sort of called the service class, the working class, who can't make ends meet. So what are your thoughts about where we are today with the Democrats in power? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So let's talk more about the professional class, because this is a huge part of your book, Thomas. Tell us more what you mean by the professional class. They listen mainly to each other. They're not required to heed voices from below their circle of expertise. And you have so many examples of past presidents who actually brought in people who maybe didn't have a college degree, didn't write a book, didn't go to Yale, and actually disagreed with them, right? And you say that's no longer the case.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Well, you've said a whole lot there. Yes, the last president that did not have a college degree was Harry Truman from Kansas City, where I'm from. So I've always been sort of partial to him because of the Kansas City connection. But he was the last one. Of course he was a Democrat, because in those days that was a fairly common thing among Democrats. The professional class tends to be highly educated people. When you're a professional, you know, the sort of basic professions are law, medicine, architects, engineers, and preachers, or the clergy. That's the original sort of five professions. But there's a lot. Today, it's an enormous number of people, you know, in our sort of post-industrial economy, our white-collar economy. But basically, anybody whose expertise, you know, whose job depends on expertise that comes from academic credentialing is what it boils down to. And this usually means people with a graduate degree of some kind, but it sometimes just means people with a college degree. And it's and they are a social class, although they don't often think of themselves that way. I guess the exact definition is that professionals have the power to prescribe, which is a power that is held by no other group. They're the ones who tell us, you know, how our roads should be designed and what kind of medicine we need to take, and, you know, who get to practice before the judge, you know, get to practice law, that sort of thing. These are privileges granted in law, so they are technically speaking a elevated class, a privileged class, a class that is above the sort of common run of humanity. Now, what happens when? And this is, by the way, everything I'm saying now is not controversial. This is the basic sociology of professionalism. The only people who think it's controversial are professionals themselves, who just think it's natural for things to be this way because they're so smart. Mm. When they talk about themselves, they say, "Well, it's not that." It's not that we're, you know, our privileges are enshrined in law. It's that we're really smart. And we deserve everything we have, which is the sort of philosophy of meritocracy, which we will come to in a minute. But professionalism is it's fascinating, because what happens when a left party, when you have a two-party system and the left party in the system decides that its main constituency is not working people, but this high-ranking group, professionals? What happens when that takes place? And that really did take place. The Democrats did this deliberately over the course of the last 40 or so years. So today, when the Democrats talk about who their constituents are, that's always the first group, is professionals, white-collar, affluent white-collar professionals. That's always group number one. That's the group they listen to, the group they care about. There are other groups, of course, but professionals are the ones who come first, the ones who matter. So what happens when a left party in a system becomes a party of the professionals? Well, one thing that happens is they don't care about inequality anymore. They don't care about the middle class anymore. They cry great big tears for the declining middle class and the America that once was and that sort of thing. But they don't really care too much about solving the problem. You look at someone like Harry Truman, who I mentioned earlier, or Lyndon Johnson. These are guys that would have known what to do about the declining middle class. But our current bunch of Democrats just throws up their hands. They're like, nothing can be done. It's all globalization. It's all technology. Mm-hmm. They just don't care.
You also write that, of course, when you're talking about the upper echelons of government, you want incredibly smart people in those roles. But your argument is that those very people think that if you are struggling, and we did a show about this last week, I mean, a huge portion of this country is working now in the service economy. So retail, yeah. Janitorial, serving people, for example, and they can't make ends meet. So your argument is that a lot of the professional class believe that, well, if you're struggling, that's your fault because you just didn't get enough education.
Exactly. I mean, I've heard this, I don't know how many hundreds of times in my life. It's just a way to brush off the grievances of working people, of the kind of people you just described, to say, well, they just didn't educate. They just didn't get enough education. Look, for professionals, The class privileges of professionals are grounded in education. Education is what being a professional is all about. You have the diploma from the fancy college and the fancy graduate school. And by the way, I've got one myself. That's how I'm able to do this sort of work, write this kind of book. Their class identity is grounded in education. And so when they look out at the world, it very naturally occurs to them that every economic problem is really just an educational problem. It's a failure of individuals to go out and get educated in the fields that they need to get educated in. And they say this all the time. Barack Obama is going around the country speaking at college commencements, basically saying this right now. Bill Clinton used to say, "What you earn depends on what you learn." And in one sense, it's a platitude. We know that. We know that's true. If you go to college, you're going to probably, maybe earn more than people that don't go to college. But it's also just a way of brushing the question off, of not dealing with it. Mm-hmm. It is imaginable that you would have a system in which high school graduates could have a middle class standard of living. In fact, we had that in America,
right.
40 years ago. They still have it in countries like Germany, Scandinavia. It still exists in France, But here we just say, look. It's a failure of you to go out and get educated. That's always what it comes down to with these people.
And yet we learned last week when we had Tomorrow Drought on that 2/3 of people who work in the service economy do not have a college education. I mean, that's a huge number. We're going to take...
No, that's right. That's right. And there are people... I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, we're just going to take a quick break. Today we're speaking with Thomas Frank, author of the new book, Listen, Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. And we have a number of people on the line, and we will take your calls right after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW San Francisco. Matt Martin, station manager here at Local Public Radio, here with Laura Flynn, producer of Your Call. And we're asking for your support today as you listen to Thomas Frank in this conversation with Rose. We're asking you to give your support to local public radio. Listen Liberal is the book from Thomas Frank, and it's yours as our thanks for your support for KALW at the $120 level, 800-525-9917, 800-525-9917.
KLW is committed to new voices to public radio through our Audio Academy training program or through the San Quentin Prison Report, through our Radio Poet segment with students in San Francisco schools. When you become a member, you sustain this space on the dial that is open to all kinds of voices and perspectives.
And here at Your Call, we keep it open to you. Your support makes it possible for us to bring you into the conversation with people like Thomas Frank. These conversations matter. Your support makes them happen. And it is New Member Monday here at KALW. So you can get Listen Liberal as your thanks. And at no matter what level of support you provide, we will give you our enhanced new member pack today only. And this is, you get a tote bag, you get some stickers and a button, and also three refrigerator magnets. Really cool KALW designs on them. You'll enjoy it. Yours at any level of support today only. 800-525-9917.
So if you missed that, that's 800-525-9917. Or you could visit our website, KALW.org, and click donate. And if, again, this is our New Member Monday, so if you arrived in the Bay Area recently and KLW has helped you feel more connected, more informed about your new community, give something back to make sure it's here for everyone, and you will go away feeling just a little bit more like this is home.
800-525-9917. Claim KALW for yourself with your support. At every level, we thank you for getting involved. 800-525-9917, KALW.org. Thanks.
And today we are speaking with Thomas Frank about his new book, Listen Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. So what do you think about the Party of the People? We'd love to hear from you, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Matthew in the Bay Area couldn't stay on. He wanted to say he is a working class guy. He's angry because he cannot get time off to vote, and he feels like the Democratic Party no longer listens to us. Thomas, what could you tell us about unions? I mean, it's just been amazing to see just the utter collapse of unions over the past four decades.
When I was younger in the 1970s, in the 1960s, unions, whenever there was, you know, a blue ribbon commission set up or any kind of national initiative, unions always had a seat at the table. They were regarded as being a normal part of civil society, and that's completely gone today. And they're, you know, there's a lot of reasons for this, but one of the biggest ones is that in the 1970s, the Democratic Party decided it didn't want to be the party of organized labor any longer. It didn't want to. I mean, they still take their money and their votes, right? And they're happy to do that, but they removed organized labor from a structural position within the Democratic Party. This is way back in the 1970s. And so when you talk about the decline of organized labor, you know, you've got like Reagan's war with the air traffic controllers, you know, all of these different milestones in the destruction of organized labor. But a big part of it is the Democrats deciding that this is not who they wanted to be any longer. And then, of course, you also have NAFTA, which is another great Democratic achievement when Bill Clinton was president. And NAFTA really pulled the rug out from under these guys.
Well, Thomas, we have a number of callers on the line. So let's hear from Tim in San Francisco. Hi, Tim. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much. I really got to say it's been really wonderful to hear this. I catch a lot of grief from my Democratic friends for voicing the same opinion. My analogy is like it's the big dinner table for the rich, and the only difference is the Democrats leave crumbs, and the Republicans scrape up every. You know, that's why it's a little frightening to me, because Bernie seems to be talking like Democrats used to talk about caring about things that Democrats care about, and you know, Hillary just feels it's just tired of the choice between lousy and hellish.
Man, you and me both, brother. I tell you what, jeez, that is exactly right. And What he said about Bernie is that what the caller said about Bernie Sanders is fascinating, because Bernie Sanders really does represent this older Democratic tradition. He always talks about Franklin Roosevelt being his favorite president, and the program that he is promoting is, it looks very much like a kind of extended New Deal. You know, what's funny is that. So he's arguably the Democratic conscience. He's what the Democratic Party would look like if they had continued down the traditional path. And yet the Democratic Party today hates him. Mm. You know, every elected official, or just about every elected official in the Democratic Party, will do anything to stop this guy. It's also fascinating to me that he didn't call himself a Democrat until very recently.
Right.
Until, you know, he decided to enter their primary.
Well, he knew that if he ran as an independent, I mean, he wouldn't. He hasn't gotten much media attention last year for sure, but he wouldn't get hardly any if he ran as a third party candidate.
Right. Well, then it's the Ralph Nader question then.
Right.
You know, does he want to? Because, you know, Ralph Nader was saying a lot of the same things and was. And wound up being perceived, maybe fairly, maybe unfairly, as a spoiler who wrecked poor Al Gore's chances. You know, and I think look at what Bernie is doing. I mean, he's saying a lot of the same things that Ralph Nader said, but he's enjoying comparatively, fantastic success when you compare it to Ralph Nader.
Yeah, Thomas, just quickly, what are your thoughts on what Bernie Sanders has accomplished? I mean, in states where independents are allowed to vote, he wins. And yet his platform is called radical. His popularity shows that tens of millions of people share his views. And a lot of people are wondering, you know, why, for example, Elizabeth Warren has not come out to really say much about Bernie Sanders.
Well, I don't know the answer to that. I'm sure there's enormous pressure on every elected Democrat in this country to back Hillary Clinton. I'm positive of that.
Right.
But what's funny about Bernie Sanders' program is that it is so familiar. You know, there's nothing shocking about it. It's standard issue New Deal stuff. This is what Democrats would be selling, you know, 30 years ago. There's nothing strange or shocking about it. And he himself seems like a grandfatherly person. And, you know, the only thing that is shocking about Bernie Sanders is that for years he called himself a socialist, a democratic socialist, you know, and he is, you know, it's amazing that he's got as far as he has. He comes from Vermont, which is a stigmatized state. He's not a well-known figure. He was, you know, really a marginal figure up until he ran. By the way, I interviewed him myself back in 2014 at some length. And he was arguing, well, he was sort of debating with himself whether or not he should run as an independent or as a Democrat. And I guess he finally chose to do the latter. And I think with great success. And where is it going to go in the future? I don't know. I mean, Hillary is essentially running as the candidate of complacency. I mean, and Obama is saying, you know, in his last year as president, is basically saying the same thing. That's who the Democrats are. They don't want to change anything. They're insisting that everything is fine. Things are going to be great. And inequality is going to get worse. Everything that we've talked about, the stagnant wages, the situation of working people, labor share of national income, all the sort of economic indicators, all of this is going to get worse. And this is, by the way, on paper, we're in good times right now. Just imagine if the economy goes south in the next couple of months, which it could easily happen. You know, we're at the end of the business cycle. I think you're going to see 4 years from now, there's going to be so much more anger in this country. And you're going to see a different kind of Bernie Sanders movement. And frighteningly, you're going to see a different kind of Trump movement, or maybe, you know, another Trump. I mean, well, Trump himself, who the hell knows? But yeah.
Thomas Frank is author of the book Listen, Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. And thanks again for calling in, Tim. Let's go next to Madeline in El Cerrito. Hi, Madeline. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. This gentleman is not giving any credit to the fact that our first and only, believe me, black president has met with nothing but resistance. And he tried to do all of those things for the working class, for getting people, or whatever people needed to get themselves in better shape. Everything he tried to do, as the author knows, was short-stopped by the Republican Congress. And he seems to he cavalierly overlooks that whole issue. Now, maybe when we get rid of our black president and get a white one back, there'll be some, or a yellow one or a red one, we'll get more cooperation. But right now he's run up against the stone wall, and you know it. Don't put it on him.
All right. Thank you, Madeline. What about that, Thomas?
Well, of course, that's true. Once the Republicans took the House of Representatives in 2010, you know, and 2011, then Obama could no longer get anything through Congress. But if you look at the things that he did get done, I mean, Obama did have the wind at his back in 2008. He had the world at his feet. He was a hero. Came into the presidency. My view is he could have had whatever he wanted in 2009. And he chose a certain path. You know, and again, I'm talking about the early years of his administration here. Once the Republicans took Congress, the caller's right. It was almost impossible for him to get any of his big things done, although he still wants to get the Trans-Pacific. He thinks he can get the Trans-Pacific Partnership done in the next year or two. But if you look at what Obama did when he had the power, when he could get whatever he wanted, and look at how he chose to play the game, right? He didn't, you know, especially with regards to Wall Street, he didn't unwind any bailouts. He didn't fire any of the management of these Wall Street banks, which, by the way, Roosevelt did. He didn't, you know, he didn't unwind any of the bailouts. He didn't prosecute any of the bankers, and that goes on to this day. You know, the statute of limitations hasn't lapsed on these guys. He could prosecute them today if he wanted to. It would make him a hero if he did it. He chooses not to. For reasons of his own that we don't – well, we do know why. We'll talk about that later. You look at the great things that Obama did do. By the way, to go back to the bailouts for a second, there was a middle-class bailout on the table. Remember, people were so angry because the Wall Street banks got bailed out, but average middle-class homeowners didn't. They went down. A lot of them lost their houses. You're in the Bay Area. You know about this. And there was something on the table to help them out. It was called cram down. It's an ugly word, but it was on the table. It's not a radical proposal or anything like that. Obama didn't lift a finger to get this through Congress, even though Congress was entirely controlled by Democrats. He did nothing. You look at organized labor, they supported Obama in an enormous way in 2008. They had one demand from him. They wanted one thing. It was called the Employee Free Choice Act. You know what this was? It would have made it much easier to form a union in the United States. I mean, a long overdue reform, right? Long overdue reform. Obama said he was in favor of it. Again, he did nothing to get it through Congress. Absolutely nothing. And it died. What he did get through Congress, he got Obamacare and he got Dodd-Frank and he got the stimulus, I should say. He got the stimulus. That was important. But all of these were too little, too late, you know, really kind of half-assed. You look at Obamacare, which is, you know, it does have subsidies for poor people in it. And that's a wonderful thing. That's like one of the best things Obama did as president. That's one of the things I like about him. I'm very pro that. But it's also Obamacare basically locks in the health insurance industry for life. Mm-hmm. If you ever go and look at the big health insurance companies and look at their stock chart and what happened once Obamacare was passed. I mean, these people have a right to unlimited profits forever thanks to Obamacare. It's the most extraordinary development, you know. Or you look at Dodd-Frank, which is supposed to be the, you know, our generation's answer to Glass-Steagall. It's 20,000 pages long. It's not even done yet. They're still working on it. They're still writing it here in Washington, D.C. The regulators are writing it, and the lobbyists are working on it, and they're writing loopholes and exceptions, and it gets longer. There was a headline the other day. This is so depressing because, as I say, I'm one who had great hope about Barack Obama when he came in. But it was a headline about the Dodd-Frank Act and how they, after all these years of negotiation, how many years has it been now? 6 years since it passed. They finally finished their rule on Wall Street bonuses. Did you see this? And after all these years and all of this arguing back and forth with the regulatory agencies and the lobbyists, they've extended the time period in which bankers get their bonuses from 4 years to five. All that work, all those pages, and that's all he got. And then the article had this, oh, it was so sad. It had Obama personally going to the regulators and asking them, pleading with them, imploring them to finish their work on Dodd-Frank before he leaves office. how many years are we since the crash? I mean, he could have, I mean, you think of that, how easy it would have been to just say, okay, we're reversing the deregulations of the Clinton years. You'd have a bill that was maybe 2 pages, maybe 3 pages. Instead, 20,000 pages.
Well, okay, no, thank you for calling, Madeline. We actually have a related call from Tom in San Francisco. Hi, Tom.
I remember the inauguration, his first inauguration. Millions of people on the mall. It was a World Cup moment. The whole world was watching. And
that's
I remember
exactly right.
He, you know, made a speech, and then he turned around, and right there he pulled the plug on the people. He could have asked for emails. He could have asked for texts to go to Congress and just swamp them, but he could have championed the people, and Congress would have had to react. But right there and then, he pulled the plug on his power. He could have been the cheerleader of the country. And instead of nationalizing the banks nationalized the country. Mm. And Bernie is saying what is needed. He's hitting the nails on the head. And, of course, the Republicans and the Democrats both don't want to give up their power. They both share a monopoly on who's going where in this government. And I believe that's where we are.
Can I add a very interesting an idea of mine to what the caller just said? You know, it is true that Obama had the opportunity to be another Franklin Roosevelt. That's what everybody was saying in 2008 and 2009. And he didn't do it for whatever reason, you know, and I go into this at great length in Listen Liberal with my speculation about why he didn't do it and why he didn't act more forcefully. But a lot of Democrats now are trapped with our old hope. You know, our hope is dragging us down because we want to believe that he was a great president. And that belief is, you know, blinds us to everything else that's happened. He wants to get the Trans-Pacific Partnership passed now. Mm-hmm. This is a trade deal written by lobbyists that will lock in, you know, for example, certain policies having to do with prescription drugs. Okay. By the way, that's another thing. Obamacare was an enormous handout to Big Pharma. Again, for reasons that I describe in Listen Liberal, but the Trans-Pacific Partnership is going to be a deeply harmful thing. But we want to believe that Obama is a great man. So deeply do we want to believe that because we've invested so much in this guy, and I'm just saying we have to regard him the way we regard every other president. In my view, he's a highly intelligent. I've met Barack Obama. He's a highly intelligent man, the most gifted public speaker of his time. You know, a very intelligent man who is in some ways a tragic figure, was brought down by his own faith in the genius of his colleagues. You know, you look at the people that he appointed, all of these Harvard people, all of these Rhodes scholars, all of these sort of orthodox professional achievers. And what did they give him? You know, they gave him a lousy program. You know, they gave him a half-hearted program. They gave him that. You look at the stimulus. It's like something that was generated in an economist's spreadsheet. It's like the result of a long equation. And that's what they gave him. They're like, here it is. You know, spend the money. There's no inspiration there. There's no WPA. There's no Roosevelt-style leadership there. People can't even remember what the stimulus was about. You know, a third of it was tax cuts. A big part of it went to charter schools, you know. And it's like, what a missed opportunity. You know, it's so sad. But we have to confront reality if we're going to understand what's wrong with the Democrats.
Thomas Frank is author of the book Listen, Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. And we've got time for a few more calls. Thanks for calling, Tom. Let's go next to Lisa in San Francisco. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. This is a great program.
So
the point that I want to make is really about what is happening in San Francisco as it pertains to the Free Capital Democrats who worked for Obama and worked for Clinton, like David Plouffe, who worked for Obama and now is the chief mastermind at Uber, and then also Chris Lehane, who was the primary spokesperson for Bill Clinton, and now he's the global strategy guru for Airbnb. And these people are implementing, I mean, they're so brilliant media-wise. They're controlling all of the messaging for these two companies and the whole gig economy that is really responsible for, I believe, the working poor, the teachers who are working two and three jobs, and also our truly affordable housing crisis. And, you know, people say there's nothing we can do. I really believe that this coming election, locally, people need to engage and they need to vote for supervisors who will implement truly progressive policies.
Well, thank you. And to add to your list, Jay Carney, who was Obama's chief spokesman, now works for Amazon. Mark Penn, a veteran of Hillary Clinton's campaign, is at Microsoft. Lisa Jackson, Obama's former EPA chief, is at Apple.
Yeah.
And they're controlling the messaging. Yes.
Yeah. This is the revolving door in action. So when Obama started, Rose, there's all of this public outrage about the revolving door with Wall Street. All
right.
These Goldman Sachs guys and, you know, who's the Secretary of the Treasury now? It's Jack Lew, came from Citibank, you know, all over the place, these guys. And but now the revolving door, that's sort of done, right? They don't hire a lot of guys from Wall Street anymore. But now it's all of these Silicon Valley people coming into Washington, and then Democratic officials going out of Washington. They're all going to Silicon Valley to work for these companies. That's exactly right. I mean, some of my friends say they're, you know, that's the new Wall Street. And that's sort of how Listen Liberal ends. One of the things that just astonished me while I was doing the research for it, you know this guy Eric Schmidt, the former CEO of Google?
Yes.
You know who I'm talking about, right?
Yes.
So this guy, he keeps cropping up in Democratic Party gatherings. Like, I'm watching a video of Obama's first press conference after he's elected president in 2008. And who's on the stage? It's Eric Schmidt. Mm. I'm reading the transcript of a Hillary Clinton speech in The Hague in the Netherlands, right? And she gives a shout out to Eric Schmidt, who's standing there in the crowd. He just keeps showing up and keeps turning up all the time. The relationship between, this is the new thing to keep your eye on, the relationship between the Democrats and Silicon Valley. And I think it's a very similar kind of relationship that they look at the Democrats, you know, like I said, the party of the professional class. They look at Silicon Valley and they see people very much like themselves. And this has been going on and building for a very long time. You know, that the Democrats have been in love with high tech and, you know, talk about how wonderful this industry is. But, you know, they are slowly becoming much more. By the way, can I just go back and say something interesting about Uber and the gig economy, which, as the caller pointed out, I mean, this is the economic neutron bomb. You know, once this logic gets extended everywhere, you know, that's it for good jobs with benefits. And it's hilarious now that they're basically selling it the same way they sold Barack Obama in 2008, as popular empowerment. Mm. I mean, I shouldn't laugh because it's so awful, but it's you know, it's ironic.
We did a show last week with Robert McChesney, who wrote a book about automation.
Oh, he's one of my heroes.
Yeah, and he's got a great new book out about automation. And he heard Eric Schmidt at Davos recently say that 50% of jobs in the U.S. are going to be wiped out because of automation. And so this stuff is all connected.
Yeah, and but what's Eric Schmidt's solution for it? That's what's fascinating. They don't have one.
Mm.
You know, these guys, they don't have one.
And also, you know, as you write, these guys are socially liberal, but when it comes to economic policies, they're very libertarian.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. But that's the Democratic Party now as well. There are some weird. So my last book, Rose, was about the Tea Party movement. And I spent a lot of time when I wrote that book reading Ayn Rand, you know, which I had never done before. And, it was shocking and horrifying in all sorts of ways. But what surprises me is how similar a lot of the leading Democrats' views are to conservative views. So the word that describes the sort of professional class worldview is meritocracy, the idea that you get what you deserve, that the people who are at the top of our society are there because they deserve to be there. Now, for the conservatives, it's always they deserve to be there because they're such incredibly productive businessmen or something like that, like Ayn Rand, right? They're like these heroic engineers who have built some fantastic company or something like that. But the Democrats say no, they deserve to be there because of their achievements in school. So it's a different way of establishing their worthiness. It's always education and, you know, how they got a gold star from their teacher in elementary school and they got into a fancy, what they always say, a good school. They got into a good school, you know, when they got out of high school and they went to a fine graduate program or whatever it is, or they were a Rhodes Scholar, or got a genius grant or something like that. But it's always about their smartness. Mm. And they rationalize the sort of hierarchy in our country by pointing to that. So it's very similar to the Republican, to the conservative way of looking at things, only it's based on a different sort of standard of merit, if you will. Rather than money, it's, straight A's.
Well, Thomas, you end your book by saying the course of the party and the course of the country can both be changed, but only after we understand that the problem is us.
Yeah, it is us. It is us. It's people like me. I have a PhD. I'm one of this group. And the whole idea of this book is to make these people look in the mirror. You know, look, being a liberal is fueled by the idea of your own virtue, of what a good person you are. I mean, I live among these people. You see it every day. This is how they go through their day, is by understanding that they are such superior individuals. And my whole object with Listen Liberal is to put a crack in that mirror, in that rosy self-image. Only when they understand that it just ain't so, that in fact they are acting as much in their self-interest as any Ayn Rand-reading Republican. Only once they understand that can we start to see some change.
Thomas Frank is the author of Listen Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. And Thomas is going to stick around with us for just a couple minutes. And I'm here in studio with General Manager Matt Martin. Hi, Matt.
Good morning, Rose. Good morning, Thomas. We're taking a moment here at the end of the program to ask for your support. We are in our spring membership campaign. We've raised over $200,000. KALW listeners have been quite amazing. But right now we have a challenge to get 20 people to support KALW during this hour of your call. And if we do, a few generous listeners, Peter and Marcy Joseph, Vicki Maxwell, Patricia Lawton, and Shanna and John O'Hare, will put in an additional $1,000 for KALW.
Thank you so much. 800-525-9917 or online at kalw.org. We are having a great morning so far. And Thomas Frank, you're going to stick around with us for a couple minutes. You've been on KALW many times. Tell us about the importance of a station like this.
Oh, well, it's the only kind of place where you're going to hear the sort of views that we're talking about. Earlier in the show, we were talking about, you were mentioning all the authors that are having so much trouble getting their word out. You've worked so hard on a project, you've studied and researched and spent all this time in the library digging everything up, and then you launch your book out into the world. And you say you're not part of academia. This is what I do for a living. I write these books and I try to get ideas out there. And your radio station, I mean, this is it. This is how we get the ideas across. It's through you guys. You know, there is no other medium for people like me.
Well, and if you support that kind of programming, it's so important. We've had a lot of authors on who say, thank you, I cannot get on some other shows. That is why we need your support. 800-525-9917. You can also go online to kalw.org.
We have Listen Liberal, Thomas Frank's new book, yours for a $120 contribution at 800-525-9917 or kalw.org. The lines were lit up during the show, Rose. As you and Thomas started talking, people wanted to get involved. Lots of people calling to the pledge room while you were having your conversation, because I think they're really drawn in by, here's a critical perspective that doesn't, this is a critical perspective on the Democrats that isn't coming from the GOP, which is, of course, most media. They say, hey, we got our Republican, we got our Democrat, we are done. That's not how it works here at KALW, and that's certainly not how it works on your call. 800-525-9917, kalw.org. We have a challenge. We want to claim these additional $1,000, and we do it on the basis of participation. Every call, every click at whatever level makes a difference.
800-525-9917. For $120, we will send you Thomas Frank's new book, Listen Liberal. I learned a lot in his book, and we've done so many shows on this. There's a lot of new information in here. 800-525-9917. Last week, we did a show about automation. We did a show about the working class, about evictions. And now we're talking with Thomas Frank about how we got here. That is the kind of programming that is so crucial right now. And by calling 800-525-9917, you are supporting that kind of programming. And we didn't realize it when we booked all these shows, but we surely were able to connect the dots. There's a thread that's been going through a lot of these shows.
Well, because these are concerns that are on everybody's mind right now. Go ahead, Thomas.
Can I throw something in?
Please.
So, a direct connection with what you're describing and Listen Liberal is when I describe the 1996 Telecommunications Act.
Right.
Do you remember this?
Yep.
The deregulation of radio back in the Clinton days when basically I used to work in radio, you know. It was a college station, but I knew a lot of people in real radio at the same time. And it was like dropping a bomb on the radio world. All of a sudden, every, you know, stations, there used to be a lot of stations that dealt with local stuff and had interesting people on, and that's what they're gone now. You guys are one of the last survivors. Do you remember this?
Yeah.
It was like everything all of a sudden became part of a chain, and there's just one guy in a, you know, a studio in New York or in Los Angeles or something like that that's doing programming for the entire nation.
And
for
that's what we've got here. We've got an independent station because so many people have supported it. We've been around 75 years.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's people don't realize, well, maybe they do realize what a valuable thing this is and how rare this is any longer.
Well, support this kind of treasure. 800-525-9917, KALW.org. Thomas Frank, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for your support.
Of course, anytime.